this is the testing, the power of testing tutorial. There was homework for this. It is on the wiki website, all the homework. You should have done that before you came. First of all, we have Peter Miller, Uber Geek number one, Eric, Uber Geek number two, and Rob, Uber Geek number three. All three have extensive software experience, and I've learned a hell of a lot by talking to them at various times. Thank you, gentlemen. Away you go.
So we've got a paper we've put together, which is being presented tomorrow, called Do It Our Way. Do you want to relate your quote, Eric?
Yes. I was working with a fellow who was writing all this code in C, and he had this ad hoc testing. So he'd write this new module, and then he'd modify the module that pumps data into a new module, run it through a few times, look at stuff in memory to see if it was all, it was a small embedded system, so he'd actually look at stuff in memory and then say, oh yeah, that looks right. Then he'd revert the changes back in the model that he'd modified to provide data for it, and that was the end of his testing. And I said, look, this doesn't work. And he says, well, you know, I've been doing it this way for years, it works for me. And I said, I've tried it your way, I think it's time for you to try it my way. And he said, no, it'll slow me down. I then spent, on the request of my management, spent 5 weeks writing tests for his stuff. And the first 2 weeks, I was logging about 15 bugs a day into the bug tracker. He eventually came along around to the idea of testing, but only if I was doing his testing. But that's another story.
So, what we're trying to do in this tutorial is to teach 4 of the splinter skills, the specific techniques we've identified in our paper, which is being presented tomorrow. And we hope that they will either be really easy and natural to you, in which case we'll rejoice because there'll be more people doing testing and better software for us to use. Or there'll be something new or a modification of what you're doing and you'll find it useful and be able to take it away and use it. Due to time constraints and some difficulty in estimating exactly how hard it will be for you to pick up and run with these techniques, we've only got 4 on today. If we get through some subset, that's also okay. So let's get on with it. So the first technique, it's a fairly obvious one. If you've got, sorry, this question?
This may be a stupid question, but I'm vaguely familiar with the term PAL, but how do you define it?
It was just a really clever
It was a play on TAL.
Yeah.
Right.
How TAL. Yeah, nothing more than that.
Yeah.
So you probably know more about how. If there isn't such a thing as how, you probably know more about it.
We didn't know there was a word called how.
In Chinese, it means good.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Wonderful.
I think they said that word.
I think so. That's fantastic. That really is.
That doesn't mean Eric's an idiot.
So, I mean, it's fairly obvious. If you've got a very large amount of work to do, you have to start somewhere, and you may as well start with the smallest thing that you can do and then build up, and you build up a larger path. So, to do this, as it says on the board, just write something small. Write some larger tests that test the combined functionality, and at the end of the process, you want to have a smoke test that just makes sure the whole thing sits together smoothly. And by writing about the same number of tests each level granularity, what we mean is that if you have, say, 4 components right down at the guts, each component might get 10 tests. And then when you combine them together, you should just do 10 tests of the combinations. You don't need to do 40 tests at that combining level. And if you have one single sort of smoke test that's testing the entire stack of what you're doing, you don't need to do another 40 tests at that level. You only need to do 10 or so for each identifiable thing you're testing. And if you're testing the combination, do 10 tests on combining. If you're testing end-to-end, do 10 tests on end-to-end.
10 to 9 is a substitute for whatever sense.
Yeah, so do foo tests. Doesn't sound as nice.
N.
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 N. So what we've got here as an example is libgmp, which has some internal structures that aren't very visible, but can be useful in testing, and we want to write a little tool to dump out the content of those. And that's, your homework is preparing you to be able to do that easily. The second technique, which combines with this first one quite usefully in the scenario we've got, is what we've called placeholder result. We're also calling it you'll know it when you see it. And the idea here is that rather than mentally simulating some potentially very complex process, or doing it on a piece of paper until you've figured out everything about what the test results should look like, it's often much easier, if you imagine a parse graph or disk layout, to do the thing and to inspect what you get out. As a human, you can say, yes, that's what I expected. It's correct. Take the result that was spat out by your program and put it into your test as the expected result. Actually, I should probably say that. Do you guys all know the basis of testing? That you have a scenario which has some setup, an expected result, and you run your code and you should get an actual result, and then you compare them. If they're the same, your test is passed. If they're not the same, your test has failed. Well, you all do now, so that's good.
And quite often you might have things like, you know, internal data structures in whatever you think, and, you know, how do you compare before and after? Well, dump it to text, and then you can diff. You know, once you've got that text output, you can then diff expected result versus what you're actually dumping out of your program or the module you're testing.
So this particular approach is simply one that says, rather than spending a lot of time doing what you want the computer to do, get it to do it and then check it did it right. Again, this stuff is pretty...
Sometimes you have your test set, and it sort of evolves, and then, like, you know, you have a test that says, you know, find X amount of things in this test set, and there's going to be 5 of them, and then, you know, you go and change your test set to add this other test condition, and then all of a sudden there's 6, and so all your tests start failing. Is there a way of...
Yep, you'll definitely want to come and see the paper tomorrow.
I did exactly this thing on what was basically a compiler, and the test inputs and outputs were constantly changing, and with the sort of rapid techniques I was using, it was very easy to keep the whole thing up to date and just only check, using things like graphical diff tools, it was possible to only check the bits that would change and saying, is that right, commit both the, and then commit to revision control, both the new expected result and the way we go for the next test.
But there's also things you can do in terms of isolation there. If you're changing your test set each time and you've got n results that have been checked against one test input, perhaps you actually need n test inputs, and that way you won't be interacting with them all. So this is the first example. The idea here is that you guys sit down and do it, and when you've got questions, there are 3 of us who all know what one form of this looks like as finished code, and we can wander around and talk to you. And it is a tutorial, so we're expecting everyone to be talking with each other about this, rather than us standing up at front and saying, okay, time starts now, let's see
what you get.
Yeah. So when you've applied that patch, you'll have a tests mpft-dump.c file in the source code for GMP. You can run this in the test suite by doing make check. CD down into that directory and do make check, it will complete a lot faster. And the goal here is to use these first 2 techniques. Start small and build up, and placeholder result, to build a MPFT, which is a floating point type structure dumper. So we should be able to get a char star out that represents one of these things in an unambiguous, clear and easy to read manner. Any questions at this point? What we've provided is the test machinery so that you have a test script that can run, and it's got the initial setup code and teardown code that the GMP test environment needs, and we have not provided the dumper. So you're providing the dumper and you're providing the tests at the same time. Because the dumper is actually a small amount of code. Again, time constraints, we can't really give something that's testing 10 or 20 real independent modules in an hour and a half tube. The amount of code you should be expecting to get in, including the tests, East and the sea is around about 40 or 50 lines tops. So it should be nice and self-contained.
You're talking about a smoke test, which is a phrase I haven't heard before. Does it just mean a test of the whole system?
Well, it's a test, and when it fails, the magic smoke's gone out. But it doesn't give you a great deal of diagnostics because it's using the entire spectrum of what you've got.
It's also like electronics. First of all, turn it off, see if anything starts smoking. It's meant to be a small representative set of tests.
Is there a question up the back there? No? So check underscore dump is the point where you can start writing a test, and clearly at C it should be easy to add more tests if you want more things to test. There's a little bit more stuff I forgot to mention. There's an assert string function in, sorry, assert always is a defined function inside GMP which will compare a condition and exit the test script if the condition isn't met. So can capitals assert underscore always open bracket and just like you do an if statement, whatever you want in there, end bracket, semicolon. And that's the basis on which they build the tests. We can try out as much of this as we think is useful for the bootstraps.
That's 51, you won't actually get source. No, you want GMP, the GMP.
Thank you.
mentioned the grammar correction test, the dumb function which creates an object, holds an object which turns into a string, and then you sort always with the return value from that function and a constant string. Okay. The constant string is your placeholder result, so you put I have no idea or something. And it will initially flash, and the sort always will print all the information you have. What you gave it, what it actually got.
Is there a good reference to GMP somewhere?
Online, the GMP documentation is pretty comprehensive and it's got all the MPF functions. I'll dig up a URL for you in 2 seconds.
Swaps.com.
The reason that we're putting the term structure into a string into another function is that we would anticipate using it numerous times in numerous tests.
There were two things I did when I was putting this together that I thought would make life easier for me. The first one, can you read that window we've got there, or do I need to make the font bigger? How do we do this? First thing I thought would be really useful is because I want to be able to compare the output easily. The easiest way to do that is if I have the string. So I added a macro to assert, using assert always to show me the actual difference between the strings. So this little macro, assert string always, is something you might want to just grab. All it's doing is doing a string comp, and if there is a difference, it print f's that out, and then it goes through to the assert always macro that the GMP, the other GMP tests use. And that made it quite easy for me to write this first test here, which is testing the contents or the printing out just the limbs themselves. So within the MPF data structure, which is defined in the GMP.h, you've got a set of limbs, and there's one more limb than there is the size of the data structure, which is the next level of complexity. So this is just the absolute internals. I wanted to make sure they could print out properly. So MPFT is a C struct. The init set string initializes it from a string, which has got a mantissa, an exponent, and a base. I call the function I've written that I think does the right thing to dump the float out. And I just have, this is the result I wanted. And then I assert that it's printed out the correct result. Now, different versions of GMP actually have quite different internals, so you may get a very different result on your specific machine. But it will be the same result every time that you're on the code. And then I free the temporary variable I created. I've cheated a little bit here and put in two tests in a row because I wanted to make sure it wasn't a fluke and I wasn't just reading something from the stack or something silly like that.
Could you scroll up a little?
Now, let me dig up that URL because the details for how MPFs are structured is actually
we're leaving the
handler.
Oh, it's just a URL there. You can probably, oh, you can't quite copy and paste to the screen. I searched for mpf underscore t and then mpf underscore init underscore set underscore str. So, looking at the time, we probably want to move a little bit further forward. How about I just walk through this one? So unless there's a bunch of objectives, what I'm going to do is to just walk you through the resulting code and how it was built up. No one's objecting. That's good. Okay. So the very first thing I did is I wrote this mpf lim dumper, which is the one you've just been looking at, which just takes two floating point numbers and tries to dump their lims only to make sure that I've got that bit working. I did this because the structure of mpft is that it has three ints in it, the precision, the size, and the exponent, and then it has a variable amount of data in the lims. It's an array of an internal data type. Now these numbers all happen to have four, but if you get very big numbers, they add lims as needed. So the actual code to do that then is also fairly small in that there's always going to be one limb there because the number of limbs is one plus the size in the MPFT field. Size is the precision count. So what I had to do is just to write a loop that would execute at least once and put these into a string. So I just use ASPrintf, which I don't know if it's a POSIX standard or a GNOME extension, but it has the nice property that allocates the string for me, so I didn't need to worry about buffer overflows or other such idiocies. And even for sample code, I kind of object to doing it wrong. So it loops around, and each time it just appends the decimal representation of the lim to this set, which is the line here. This is test code itself. It's part of the test suite. That's why I'm writing it. So I want to know if this function fails, I want it to bail out, and so I use the assert always function from their test suite to check the result code of every function I call. Except for free, if free fails, I don't really want to know about it. Okay, any questions on that? Does it all make sense?
I'm really happy that this test suite actually checks that all memory is free.
Yes.
At the end of it, and actually causes a failure for me. That's just problematic.
So one of the things we talk about in the paper is you know, test infrastructure should really aid you in making sure your code is correct. And the GMP test suite is very nice.
And the more pedantic your test is, the better it's going to be at catching unintentional slip-ups.
So having successfully, I can make this a bit wider, I think.
You said that you were cheating before when you used the same function to test a couple of things.
Yes.
Is that why do you consider that cheating? Because like sometimes you have to do a lot of setup and then do a lot of tests and then tear down. So it makes sense to put all these tests together.
That makes your test suite less flexible, and the less flexible it is, the harder it is to change the code that's testing. So over time, that becomes more and more difficult to work with. And I'm in it's a habit I've got into, I think both me and Eric, me, Eric and Peter have all got into, is not doing that.
But then you're wasting a lot of time on doing the same setup and tear down all the time. If that's expensive, then.
So what you need is some functions which will do the setup of the state you need very, very quickly.
Okay.
And because they know about the internals and how your system works, even if you are actually working with databases, they can do things like dropping an exact representation of the database into place. There are ways you can balance these two things.
What about if you have like tests and they say that they depend on other tests being run?
That's
another way. of saying that you've got the same situation.
Yes, it is. But then in that case, you know, we can still add new tests and just say, I depend on a certain state.
Well, you were talking about efficiency before. It's not really efficient to do a bunch of assertions that aren't relevant to the test you're trying to execute. You only want to check any one assertion once, unless it's a very, very, very cheap assertion like these little function check ones. So, no, I wouldn't do that. It will still be hard to modify. If you need to go to one of these underlying tests and change it because you're changing the API of your program, you're going to break all your other tests. And
the other thing that's important to remember is that unlike humans, the computer doesn't get bored. If your test suite takes a little bit longer, I don't have a problem with that. It doesn't get bored. I do. I don't run manual tests. I'm bad at them. I get bored and go to stuff like that. The computer doesn't get bored, so go and have a cup of coffee. The smoke test should be quick. It should be a representative set of tests that you can run easily and often. And then you can run the entire test suite and don't mind yourself.
Notwithstanding that, as a data point, the BZR test suite's got 4,500 tests, it takes 5 minutes to run.
That's the entire
regression test suite. And it's doing version control, just about every single test is working heavily on disk. It's possible to make these things fast. I think you need to ask yourself, what is more valuable, the correctness and flexibility of your code, or the time it takes to run the tests? You know, it's not an easy answer, but you have to understand that you are making a trade-off when you let those two things interfere with each other. So, this was the second test, building up slightly more functionality this time. This test is using the function we've already tested and the full dump function, and it's trying to get the complete structure dumped out. So, MPF precision 3, size 1, exponent 1, and whatever the limbs are in square brackets, because I thought this was a reasonably easy way to make it clear what I was seeing on screen if the test failed. And again, because of the test suite here, I have to free things I've allocated, but the assertion just uses the string difference. And this is where the placeholder value comes in. When I was writing this test, the way I did it, and that's what we're, I mean, obviously our theory on how the tutorial might work well wasn't quite right. But the way I wrote the test is I started with the result of that. In fact, I started with not valid. And then I ran it. And it came back with that. And I said, okay, that looks good to me, because I don't know anything about how GMP's internals work. But the limb dumping, I'm sure of from the previous one, and the precision, size, and exponent, I dropped into GDB, and it was printing out the values that were in the structure. As I said, I don't know enough about GMP to say whether they're the right values, but it certainly is accurately reflecting the internals. And so I did the same thing here. For the non-zero result, I wanted another data point to make sure I wasn't printing the wrong area of memory. If I'm printing out part of the code, it's not going to vary every time, but it's also not going to be the correct thing. The functions for these are actually very simple. The dump MPF function just starts with the limbs as a variable and then does a string format of the ints and the limbs with a square bracket around it. That's here. So it's now 11:43, so we're about halfway through. Who'd like a 5-minute break, stretch legs, anything like that?
5-minute break to ask us questions. Quiet things about that.
No? Okay, that's easy. Okay. Put your hand up if you're listening. All right. Okay. So the next two techniques are somewhat larger, so we're going to do them one at a time. From the tutorial page, there's a Venus tar.bz and a couple of extra files to download. Probably, though, we'll just walk through it bit by bit rather than setting sort of something you can work through. Although it may be easier in this case, I don't know really. So divide and conquering the code, the idea is, and we've got a space constraint here, that's why we've got the separate paper where we go into a whole bunch more detail. The idea is, though, that when you're testing things that have external dependencies, and And this can come in a whole bunch of shapes. It can be things that are outside your control, like the actual internet, DNS servers, NFS servers. Or it can be things that are within your control, but they're very expensive, like databases, large amounts of random data. Don't use them. Find or create if it doesn't exist enough modularity in your code that you can replace those resources when the test is running. And you can, in fact, replace them with different things for every single test instance you've got, if that makes sense for your problem. By doing this, you reduce the dependencies between the test you're running and other parts of the code base or other unrelated things, which means that your test is more repeatable, it's got better isolation, and usually it becomes a lot faster. So the example we had here is Venice, which is a branch of Planet. So you've seen planet.linux.conf.au, that's the output of this program. And we wanted to write a test for it that would check it actually goes off to an HTTP server and pulls down the feed and then formats and writes it to the local page. Now obviously it does do that because Planet works today. I'm not out to find bugs. What it's out to do is to demonstrate how we can actually use the code that thinks it's talking to an HTTP server without having to have one. So I need to copy around files again. Give me another couple minutes. If you want to, you can look at the test_dac.py file, which has a full test with the assertions. The only thing missing is that it will fail at the moment, because there is no web server at example.com with the RSS feed it's looking for. And so that's the thing, that it's hard to write this test. If we do it by hand, we have to bring up a real web server. But it's a very, very, very small way of bringing up a sample data that will just work.
And the point of the name of this technique is that instead of trying to test all of the code one, particularly if you're suddenly lumped with an enormous testless legacy piece of code, is you can do it a piece at a time, find a sensible piece, and subdivide your problem. It's very often the case that a legacy piece of code will have no tests, and you want to make a modification. The first thing you have to do is add some tests to make sure you don't break anything. But what do you add, how do you add it, where do you add it? Because you've got this thing with snakes for hair and you have no idea which bit to grab. Start small. Break it up into pieces, as logical as you can find, and deal with smaller pieces. Subdivide the code. There's an interface that you want to check cross and replace one half of that interface. Code that's been testing and the other guy, whatever that is. That's what we mean. Divide the code base up into small pieces.
So who's got Venus? Who's done the download of these things? Great, okay. So what I'm going to do is I'll walk through the process of identifying where the modularity is in this case and hooking it in. So the first thing is, make sure that when you run, you should be able to run .runtests.py at the top of that, and it'll go and run off a bunch of tests. And we'll expect to get one failure. We may get another. I think the branch of Venice I downloaded was slightly broken. But we should get a failure in test spidering. Do you want me to put on the mic?
There is no mic.
Oh, well, that's easy.
Yep. Well, yeah. Here's a mic.
Oh,
here's
a mic. Here's a mic.
Sure.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Okay. So if we look at test spidering, now the one I've got here is slightly different because I've done the substitution, but it calls off some spider planet, and somewhere in there, the failure you get should be down at this line here, where it's going to say, look, I couldn't find the files you were looking for, there's only a couple there. So it's obviously gone and done something, but it hasn't successfully pulled down the data. So what I did to debug this is I added a PDB statement before the spider call, which dropped me into a debugger. So I can step into that and I can walk through and see where it starts doing HTTP stuff. Another way of doing it would have been to do things like grepping for HTTP or for URL, or other such things in the code base, because I don't know this code base at all. Now, having done that, do you have the Vance code list?
Yes.
Have you pulled it down? Where is it?
/testing.
Yep. What I'm doing just now is just setting up the structure, so I can actually show you this slide. Well, I should be able to do runtest.py now, and for me, I expect this to pass. So I'll just continue. That passed. Now, I remove my hook where I'm inserting my module and run this, it should now fail. So, wrong number of files. This is the failure you should be seeing right now.
Okay.
So, I'll run it, and this time I'll step into it. And it's not a particularly small function that steps into, which is a bit frustrating. So I can look at the code, and I can see that it's doing some socket stuff, it's setting up some multiple threads. Okay, it's got a comment here that for each thing that's been subscribed to, it's going to go off and do it. And when I look at that, the only thing I can really see is it puts it on the queue, and then it gives back queue results, and then tries to parse stuff, and it goes off into this right cache, but it doesn't seem obvious to me about where it's actually going and doing things. However, right cache has taken this data block, so possibly that's a good thing to look at. Another possibility is this feed parser.parse, maybe going off and doing the connection and getting what's going on. So I'm going to drop out debugger and just have a quick sniff around the code. So I'll start with this feed parser because we are dealing with feeds here. And it's taking a URL in. And this line looks very interesting. That looks to me like a place where it's going off and actually going to be talking to the internet. URL, file stream, or string. There's a pretty good variable name there. So if I want to change the behavior of Spider Planet, I need to change the behavior of Open Resource. But I might need to go deeper in than Open Resource. I don't know enough about the code base yet. So let's have a look at Open Resource. Open Resource takes any input source and deals with it in a uniform manner. It just gives you a string back that's got read, rebind, rebinds, and close. That looks like something I can modify really easily. So, in terms of languages, there are a number of different ways you can hook in alternative code paths. In C, C++, or other compiled languages, you can have an alternative object file you link with that supplies the replacement interface. So you can just build however much code is needed and teach your test suite to link in this test harness source file instead of or before the alternative. If you're replacing something that's in the library, like if you're replacing the actual real POSIX connect and select calls, which is a reasonable thing to do in some situations, then you would just need another library that you put on the link line before the standard one. If you are working in a language like Ruby or Perl or Python, what you can do is at runtime change the so that it calls your code instead of calling the normal system library calls for that. And this lets you do it in a very dynamic manner and in a very quick and efficient manner. You don't need to change large amounts of infrastructure to be able to do this. So if I go back to our test suite here, what I want is I want a function which will take the same parameters as OpenResource, but will actually give back just the test data I need. So I'm going to create a stub open function, which as you can see, URL, file, stream or string, etag, agent, referrer, handlers. And I'm going to return a string IO, which is just a string that can be treated like a file. It's a standard Python facility. The feed data I've put here is just enough feed data to trigger a couple of files on disk. And all I need to do in my test is save the old function, so I can put it back when my test is finished, and replace it with my new function. Doing this, like so, will let the test complete. So the point about this is that the entire difference between the sample test file you've got on your disk and the one here, except for these extra test failures I'm getting from somewhere, I disclaim all knowledge of the rest of this code base, is that I've got a try finally around the test. So this bit here, this is the test you've got. And these three lines and these two lines substitute my little test stub open, which is it's a one-line function that's spread over menu because it's got literal data in it, for the existing function. It's this is the point of the technique. You can take something that's conceptually very hard to do because it's got lots of moving parts. I mean, bringing up an entire web server is possible. Another way of writing this test is to set up a web server, give it sample data, wait to make sure it's listening on the socket, and then run this with a URL that says, you know, localhost port 8080, so I don't have to be a privileged user, / example feed. And that would work, except it's going to be about 50 or 60 times slower because I'm bringing up a full web server. And they take a certain amount of time just to do socket, bind, wait, read data from disk, return it back to you. This operates entirely in memory. Now, one of the things you need to do, which we don't demonstrate here, is that if you replace an interface like this, your test is no longer testing the real code. So you need to make sure that the interface you've given, the substitute one and the real one, don't vary. And there are a number of ways of doing that. You can have a validator, which you run against the real interface and against your one. And in this case, the validator would be, have I got something I can do read on, read line on, read lines, and close, because that's the contract. And I need to be able to give it these parameters. On the real one, you might give it a file on disk, and on the sample one, we know, heaven knows, it's going to ignore everything and hand it back, but that's okay, because we'll be able to tell if someone goes to the real code and changes the interface in the future, this test that tests the two interfaces will break, and you'll know that something's gone wrong. Questions? Please, let there be questions.
There's some appeal to doing the open resource in the setup and teardown.
Right?
Just so you don't have to do the try finally.
Yeah, that's absolutely good. I was trying, in this case here, I was trying to demonstrate with the minimum number of assumptions about knowledge of the Python testing environment.
Okay.
The PyUnit testing environment has the ability to run code before and after your test underscore function executes. This is the setup and teardown. And this lets you factor out things that should always run before and always run after, so that you don't have to ensure they run by using try finally, and you can avoid having these individual tests. It's a place to put common setup logic.
And the other comment I had was that open resource is kind of one of those funky, internal, undocumented implementation details that you're modifying.
Yep.
Do you
but this is
that?
A black box test.
Okay, so you don't consider that a bad thing at all?
Well, we're testing the implementation. So I think
we're not testing the implementation of open resource, we're testing the other bits. This is the whole divide and conquer thing.
Yeah.
We're not testing open resource, we're testing this other
bit.
When we're confident that both pieces work, then we might try testing the two of them glued together.
No, I was just talking about it's an implementation detail you modify in the test.
Okay.
What if the test failed there if they changed the implementation to be completely correct but not used at least?
Exactly.
Yeah, so if they change things, then I think that your question there, which is about what happens if they change something so that it's still correct and our test fails, we don't have as much isolation as we'd like. If they change it, not call open resource, they're changing the structure of their code, they're changing the structure of the module. And this is a test that's testing that module. It is coupled to that structure. If we were testing something further out, I told a lie there. This isn't meant to test feed parser. This is meant to test Spider. So the problem here is that the right way to do this is to hand in to the Spider module an implementation of the interface and to have that propagate down so that the contract isn't being violated. That's somewhat longer to demonstrate. Ideally, the interface there that would pass in would be feed parser. We'd say, okay, what feed parser does Spider Panel want to use? And here's one that happens to know that it doesn't need to go off and do anything anywhere else. It's all in memory. Is that?
Yeah, I made the point that I've come across a situation in the past where you've got a whole bunch of tests on code and you want to change the code and make sure the tests still run, but you can't change the code because the tests are coupled to a specific implementation of that code. And this is an example of that.
What I've found is as you introduce more and more testing into your code becomes more modular so that it is forcing you to become more structured in your code as a whole.
But you'll have second thoughts about changing the API there or the open resource, which is primarily a part of the function.
So I should have a comment here. I actually find it easier to change the APIs internally if I test several breaks when I change the APIs.
Yeah.
Because one of two things often happens. Either you say, I have a chance to fix this flaw in the API, and you can fix it, you can test it. Or when you change the API, you discover, oh, that test actually becomes impossible, which means this use case is impossible, which means I should just revert it. And actually the latter happens more often than the former.
There's another angle on it too, which is that if you want to change the API, you're going to break all the clients anyway.
Yeah, but this is a private function.
Okay.
So
but I've already acknowledged that this isn't an ideal example of it. This was aimed to be the...
If this was a public function, then that's right. This is an excellent example of, in fact, documenting the API. Because you're, in a sense, saying, this is my API, this is how I'm supposed to be using. If you go and change that prototype, then this test is going to fail. It's going to crash out.
So the way you could write this in such a way that you're using a public function is instead of replacing planet.feedparser.openresource here, you could say old parser equals planet.feedparser.testingparser, for example. So if you did that, and we replaced the entire feedparser module, that substitutes out what is possibly more stable interface. But that's a bigger interface, and I didn't really like the idea of saying, hey guys, write an entire feed parser, even if just a demo one. It's got, I think, three or four functions that you need to figure out that aren't as obvious as just, hey, hand back a string.
You can still inherit from the original rather than just change around functions. So.
If it was a class, it's not a class.
And also, don't inherit from concrete classes. You need an abstract interface so that you can inherit from that and make a concrete real one and a concrete testing one. But don't ever inherit from a concrete class.
For testing purposes, if you inherit from a concrete class, you are not isolated from changes to the concrete class that aren't changing the interface. If you want to just be able to replace an interface, you have to be just up at the point of
software implementation.
This is a point which comes up again and again, and that is that if you're really keen on testing, if you're determined to do testing, your code will actually modify over time to become more testable. But you've got to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you start where you can, you go, you know, that's really ugly. Let's refactor a couple of things so that it's not ugly.
So,
but you've got to test, and when you refactor, hopefully it doesn't break, right? Because you've got to test, you know what it's supposed to do, you can refactor with a great deal more confidence.
Yeah. So, I mean, as a data point here, we had to do a whole bunch of setup here that I just picked up from the existing Canop test suite, which, you know, we're changing global variables on both of these. We're making directories on disk. We're changing another global variable with this config.load. I wasn't terribly worried about using an internal function when I'm already changing global state that's going to affect the rest of the test suite. I think there's a balance. When you're introducing a test into a clean environment, you can afford to be much cleaner about it. When you're introducing a test into an environment that's not as clean, then you're not going to get as much return for going through the effort of making it clean, because you're going to have to fight against a whole bunch of other constraints. And we don't do testing because we want tests. We do testing because we want high-quality software. So the focus has to be, what return am I getting for this time investment? I mean, if you enjoy writing tests for the sake of writing tests, fantastic.
Hey, I've got a project for you.
I think we all do.
So that's this technique. So on to the next one. I'll pimp the final talk again more, because we've got about four times as many techniques that we cover. It's significantly deeper, but it's not going into code examples at all. It's all just theoretical.
And particularly the paper, which we've provided as well.
Yes, the paper is the bee's nest. So one of the patterns, this is actually the pattern you asked about earlier. Why do I think it's bad? Why do we think it's bad to do multiple different assertions in one test? Well, it's not so much doing multiple assertions in one test. It's doing some setup, doing an assertion, doing some more setup, doing another assertion, doing some more setup, doing another assertion. These make tests less clear. It's not clear what the focus is on that test, because you're actually doing three or four or five sets of setup in the first place. Secondly, it becomes very hard to modify once you do this more than this very small amount, because if you want to change one of the earlier tests in that series of tests that have been done as one big one, you are more than likely going to throw out and cause damage to the later assertions. They're no longer going to have the right numbers. If they're looking at, for example, log output, there's going to be different noise at the beginning of the log you're going to have to filter out, and you end up fighting with this. It's much nicer to have, I'm testing this thing, comes up, it runs, and it goes down. And not unrelated to this, if you have a series of, essentially, they should be independent assertions going on, and one of the early ones fails for some reason, the later ones may fail as well, but you'll never know, because it won't reach them. Whereas if they were separate tests coming up in parallel, your test suite will run each of them and record that you get three or four or five or however many different failures. So you get better diagnostics by having smaller and clearer tests. And this is a fairly mechanical process. If you've got a test that's larger than it should be, just take a copy of it. Find the first assertions in it. In the copy, delete everything under those assertions. That's all part of another test. Go back to the original, find those first assertions that are now safely duplicated over there, and delete them. They're not needed. They're not part of this test anymore. You've shrunk the test. You've probably got some duplicate code at the top. Factor that out into a common helper function. Parameterize that as needed. You know, the code may not be entirely identical. And you may find that not only do you have duplicate code, you have duplicate effort, that you're redoing things in this first test that you didn't need to do twice at all, that you can just completely shrink down or eliminate. And keep repeating this until you've got a whole bunch of separate tests that do one test each. You look like you're about to ask a question.
No. The phrase there that's tricky is small enough. No, it's got to be one that makes sense. One of the snoop load of smaller commits, and that means that he takes his enormous test and commits the portion of the test corresponding to the code he's got working today. For whatever granularity you need as a project lead, you want to give them a way to commit every day or every 2 days or not less than once a week, for goodness sake.
Some of this also ties back.
Eric commits about 20 times a day. Slightly more than I do, but...
A good version control system can help, but we're not doing that talk right now.
Don't look disappointed.
Why should that much more than 20? It's really scary.
So, in the Venice source code, there is a test file there called testscrub.py. And in actual fact, the Venice tests are in pretty good shape in this regard. They all pretty much test a single thing. But testscrub future, in that testscrub.py, actually tests three different things. Do one thing, do some changes, do another, do some changes, do another, do some changes. And it's not entirely clear what scenarios it's time to test. So this one's so easy, I'm just going to do it on the fly. Air conditioner would be great.
It's warm. We can almost hit the air conditioner button for more than 10 seconds. The other light will come on and it will take a minute to come up. We found it the hard way this morning.
Do you know how to turn the air conditioner on?
No. Sylvia came in and gave the instruction from the back of the room and just said, I know the instruction.
So you're meant to hold it for 10 seconds or not?
More than 10 seconds.
Okay, just hold it.
Count slowly.
5, 7, 3. So here's the test that I'm going to use as our example here. It's not a terribly long test. Again, we had this whole tension between the amount of time in the tutorial and the amount of time that you actually need to spend to get hold of the idea and run with it. So if you look at this test, what does it actually test? Not entirely clear to me, looking at that code, whether it's doing one test, two tests, or three separate tests, or are these just assertions on the way to make sure that the test data is valid, which is one actual reason to have multiple assertions at the beginning of a test. So I'm just going to...
When I do, asserting the test data is correct, I actually tag them with preconditions.
Right, or you know, check no one, change the sample values. Right, so I think that's actually what the first two things are doing, is they're saying, look, by default, the sample data should have one entry, and it should be set to update it, so it looks like something that's going to change, because it wants to test with a known set of good samples.